All right. Good morning, everybody, and thanks for joining us for this last forum of the year. And I will be talking this morning about inequalities and one of the particular examples how to overcome inequalities in the world. Now, we are all aware of, you know, huge inequalities in the world, and the world has many different problems, but arguably the huge inequalities within countries and between countries are one of the most important and most damaging challenges probably today, because that's also background for a lot of the political challenges we have with the kind of nationalistic moves that we've seen in many countries over recent years. And the background is often that people feel excluded, that people kind of sense this injustice of inequalities. And that's why I think it's a very important topic. I will focus on one particular aspect of that, the AIDS movement, and how the AIDS movement has managed in some ways to overcome some of the most devastating inequality. And it is a story that is quite closely related to many members of our congregation, because many members of our congregation have been quite involved in that. And I will point that out as I go along in my presentation. So let's first look at the situation about 20 years from now, in the 90s, when AIDS was really ravaging across many countries around the world, reaching very high infection rates of 20, sometimes over 30% of adult population was infected with HIV in many countries. And I know that many members of our congregation experienced that themselves in their countries of origin. It was also the time when Elizabeth and I were working in Tanzania and experiencing what it meant when in a hospital 30% of your patients were infected with HIV and death was all around you. And remember, that was a time when there was no treatment yet anywhere in the world, so people were simply dying from AIDS. But the world did come together, probably in a quite a unique way, around this particular issue. And Christians in many countries and the churches and the ecumenical bodies did play a particular role in this fight against this disease that was really challenging and questioning whether there was a future for many countries, societies, communities around the world. And when I thought about the values that inspired many Christians to get engaged in this global AIDS movement, I borrowed the slide from Jonathan, because Jonathan, I thought, you know, many of the values you had when you gave your presentation on the kind of anti-nuclear movement are similar, of course. It was this strong sense that all people are made in the image of God, and God loves all people equally. So that's why should we allow millions of people to die from a disease that was then becoming preventable and treatable? The love of God and love your neighbor as yourself, life is a priceless gift, all of that played a big role also in the ecumenical formation of the response against HIV. I just added 2 points here because it was not just the biblical references, but it was also the thinking about what is the meaning of the church and the Christian community in this particular environment. And therefore, for us, two notions became very important. One of the church of one body of Christ that cannot be divided, therefore there should be no them and us. That was very, very strong those days. And also the notion of the church as a healing community, as a community welcoming to everybody, also everybody affected by this disease. And in fact, you know, particularly also here, the ecumenical bodies in Geneva had taken a very active position from early on in the fight against AIDS. The WCC Central Committee already met in 1986, very early on in the epidemic, and declared at that time, the church has AIDS. That was this statement of we are one body that cannot be divided. Between 1994 and 1997, the World Council of Churches led a study on HIV/AIDS that was then presented to the Central Committee and to the Assembly in Harare. And also, there were very important ecumenical initiatives created around that time. For example, the Ecumenical Advocacy Alliance, and again, members of our congregation have played a very prominent role in that. It was the founding director was Linda Hartke, who many might remember as a member of our congregation, also as president of our congregation for many years. And then Peter Proof led the Ecumenical Advocacy Alliance for several years. So very close association with our congregation. And then the Ecumenical HIV and AIDS Initiatives and Advocacy, EHIA. And Jambura, you've been leading that from the beginning for many, many years. So just to recognize, you know, the many ways in which the churches have become involved in that. But if we look at what really changed the trajectory and what helped to overcome some of the inequalities, we have to refer to the movement of the people living with these diseases. Because after treatment became available in 1996, AIDS turned from a tragedy that it had been from the beginning when millions of people died, but it was a tragedy because there was not much that could be done about it. But once treatment became available, it became an injustice because treatment was only available for the few who could afford. Only people in rich countries could afford treatment that at that time cost $10,000 to $20,000 per patient per year, and therefore was considered to be completely out of reach for people in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And that's what was then going to change. But it took a very powerful movement of communities, people either living with the disease or affected by the disease because they had seen how it devastated their communities. And that became a very, very powerful civil society movement around the world. But now we will ask at the end, what's the lesson from this movement? Can we also use that for other social issues, other diseases? And I think there are some lessons. But one is, you can have a very powerful civil society movement, a grassroots movement, that can have an effect, but it needs to link then to the political level. Your own can have a movement that changes the trajectory of one of the big challenges, you know, if you then reach the political level, the UN, many leaders in countries, and that's what happened, because it was brought to the political level, and it was basically this statement that I often use as an example for that. It was at the AIDS conference in 2000 in Durban, the first International AIDS Conference held in Africa. And it was Justice Edwin Cameron, a judge from South Africa who was living with HIV, who said in his speech this: I stand before you because I'm able to purchase health. I'm here because I can pay for life itself. To me, this seems a shocking and monstrous inequity, that simply because of relative affluence, I should be living when others have died. Our overriding and immediate commitment should be to find ways to make accessible for the poor what is within reach for the affluent. And I think you have to understand how extraordinary, how revolutionary that is. Because it is not very often that anybody who lives in a rich country and has access to education, schools, university would say, this is such an inequity, we can't accept that. You know, I will not rest until everybody has access to that. Or people suffering from other diseases. Johanna, we've been talking over the years many times, you know, why don't we have that for people suffering from diabetes or heart disease or cancer or other diseases? There's nobody saying, hey, you know, I'm suffering from this disease in Switzerland or the US or in Germany, and therefore I demand that, you know, this will be made available for all people concerned. HIV became like an identity for many people, and that changed the whole way the world thought about that. And for many of us sitting in the audience, listening to Edwin Cameron at that time, when we didn't really think this could be done, this could be made available across the world, it was, you know, very, very touching, as you can imagine. Shortly afterwards, Nelson Mandela asked the same audience and said, history will judge all of us harshly if we are not responding to this historical challenge. And after these statements, we knew, oh, something is going to happen here. And that from there, it went to the UN. Kofi Annan, who was then Secretary General of the United Nations. And of course, Kofi Annan came from Ghana, from a country that experienced the devastation of AIDS, and he took that as one of his courses. And he called for a UN General Assembly on HIV/AIDS, the first time in history that a health issue got onto the UN General Assembly. That was in 2001. And there was a declaration signed by every member state of the UN. And Kofi Annan said, I want a fund, I want a war chest. And he talked about a war chest of $7 to $10 billion to finance the prevention, care, and treatment that was out of reach for most people in the world. And it made its way into the declaration. And I was at that time leading the delegation of the ecumenical movement and the World Council of Churches to that UN General Assembly. And I worked from the WCC office across the UN building, so I could see after the meeting was over and the declaration was signed, I was looking at the UN building with the red ribbon and thought, my God, is this going to happen? Is that possible? So that was the big question. It was a kind of challenge, and we saw an opportunity. And Kofi Annan said, okay, I want this war chest, I want this fund, and I give you all 6 months to establish that. So within 6 months, some of us met here in Geneva for the first board meeting of the newly created Global Fund in Geneva. And a couple of months later, I joined this Global Fund and had the task ever since to mobilize these billions of dollars that we did not know whether it would ever be possible to do. And that was the moment when I joined the congregation in 2003, by the way. At that time, it was a very small team. Not only did we know where to get the billions from, but also who could do that. A small team of people. I didn't have wonderful colleagues like Charlotte at that time yet to help us with that, but that's how it started. Now we are a much bigger and much more professional team. And indeed, you know, one might argue that, at least partially, we have achieved this vision from 2001, and the Global Fund now is an organization that's a partnership, bringing together governments, non-government organizations, private sector, mobilizing about $4 billion per year, and supporting programs in about 120 countries around the world that you see on that map. So, but how was that possible? As I said, it's very important then to get, you know, from the community level to the level. And we started then to organize these replenishment conferences, altogether five so far. The last one was last year, and it was hosted by Prime Minister Trudeau. And so as an example, you can't do it without, you know, the support of the leaders of the G7 and the G20 and so on. And it was possible because it was an issue that was then high enough on the political agenda. But deliberately also, when we organized that, and Prime Minister Trudeau, you know, was a fantastic host and took the stage, we had all the kind of communities from all over the world living with and affected by the diseases on stage with him to demonstrate that this is not something driven just by a few politicians or officials in an organization, but by the people affected by it. So that has never left us, in a sense. It does help, of course, if you have then supporters like Bono and Bill Gates, who have been bought into this idea ever since 2002. And they come to many of these conferences, they mobilize, and that obviously you need some powerful allies as well, as you can imagine. So then you have to come first to the governments of the richest countries in the world so that they give you the money you need. We've been building that up over time, and it's just a map from the last replenishment where you see some of the major donors. And that most of them actually last year, in spite of what I will come to in a minute, the challenges, the challenging political environment, they still maintained, or most of them increased actually their funding. So that you know, requires a lot of detailed work, as you can imagine, in all the capitals of all these countries, working with governments, working with parliaments, working with civil society, working with media there. And that's what we do basically on a daily basis. And Charlotte could tell you some more interesting stories, you know, on the countries that we work together on, because that is part of this story. How do you translate this message of, you know, injustice and the need, you know, to make treatment available into political and financial commitment? Last week we were in Spain, one of the latest countries we mobilized to give us a contribution. So that, you know, works on the government side, and that's where most of the money is coming from. But it was from the beginning also the mandate to mobilize the private sector, which is not that easy, because private companies have not the same kind of pressure, if you like, to give money to a global cause. Some do, but most don't. And they normally don't do it unless there is a particular incentive, and they see a value in that as well. And that led us, together with Bono, whose idea it actually was in 2006, to launch what is called Product Red, where we said to the companies, okay, you can give, but not as a charity. We are not asking you for charity. We are asking to partner. And to make it sustainable, what we are asking you to do is, you have fantastic products, you sell these products, but part of the proceeds go to the Global Fund to finance AIDS treatment in Africa. And that, you know, had a slow start. We first had 5 companies. Now we have over 60 companies who do that. And they do that also partly out of their own interest, because that's a marketing tool. They know their customers, their clients, like to engage on social cause. And young people in particular, the millennials, are known for, they're looking for something to engage on. So it is not completely selfless, if you like, but I think that is okay. You know, we have to mobilize, particularly if we are talking about additional resources, we have to include the private sector. And Product Red has just now, with this World AIDS Day, reached $500 million, which is quite remarkable from private sector for a single cause. I said last week that Amazon joined this club. If anybody, you know, looked at the Amazon website on 1st of December, you should have seen that the first thing that, you know, popped up was Product Red. So we appreciate that. And there are many other companies. The beauty of this is, these are really additional resources. You know, if we mobilize more money from governments coming out of the development aid budgets, it normally means if they give more to the Global Fund, they have to give less to somebody else, right? Because it's a zero-sum game, more or less. But not for this. This is really additional. This money would never go to any other social cause unless it was, you know, they were motivated to give to Product Red. So that's why I think it's a pretty innovative program that could potentially be copied also for others. And the other area that is really additional money, because it also wouldn't go to develop otherwise, is our engagement with rich individuals, particularly from the Global South. So, right, we have Bill Gates anyway. He's one of the richest men in the world, and he gives very generously. But the key for the future is not whether Bill Gates gives a little bit more or less, or other, you know, Silicon Valley billionaires, but whether the many rich people in poor countries will start to contribute to this global cause that is affecting their own countries. And it is, you know, slowly going up. And there are some interesting examples of that, where people, mainly in Asia so far, but we are getting into Africa as well, say, yeah, you know, I've become very rich, and I want to give back to my own people, in a sense. But they use a global instrument like the Global Fund, because that is the kind of assurance mechanism that the money is used well in their countries and so on. So they buy into that. And the most prominent and most generous, actually, is this gentleman from Indonesia, Pak Tahir. And I briefly want to mention his story, because he does that because of his Christian faith. And he's very clear about that. He's a multi-billionaire, but he came from very, very, very modest beginnings. His father was a rickshaw driver and died when he was just starting university and wanted to become a medical doctor. And he had to drop university because the family couldn't afford. He did something else and created his empire that made him a multi-billionaire. And now that he has this money, he said, it's my duty to give back. And I wanted to become a doctor, and I could never become a doctor, but that's why I'm giving now to the health of my people. So he gave the Global Fund $65 million. for tuberculosis programs in Indonesia. And he's about to make his next pledge. And I was in his home, and we discussed that, actually together with Bill Gates, because one of the conditions was that Bill Gates would come for a dinner in his home. And and he did. And his wife was not around. Everybody else wanted pictures with Bill Gates and so on. And I said, where's your wife? I said, oh, she can't come tonight because, you know, she's very religious and there's an important function in the church. So she missed the dinner with Bill Gates in her home because there was a function in the church. That's truly true commitment. And then, you know, there was a bit of a discussion around that. And Bill Gates said, yeah, no, you know, I'm also a religious person, actually. And my wife, Melinda, is actually quite religious. Some of you might know. You know, so for many of them, actually, the motivation why they want to give back comes from their Christian faith. And I think it's one of the challenges. We need to get more. There are many of these people, but we need to get to them. Because this will be really additional resources for whatever social cause you might choose. So with that, sorry, it doesn't come out very clearly. It shows, you know, how over time then we were able to build up the resources. Altogether, the Global Fund mobilized now about $55 billion. Over 5 replenishments. That's where we stand today. It was growing very fast the first couple of years. Now a little bit more slowly, but it's still growing. And now I show you a slide that I like in particular. Because when we are talking about inequalities, we also have to think, where is this going? And my argument is, actually globally, inequalities are reducing. It might not be the impression that everybody has. Inequalities are increasing within countries, right? More money to the richest and less money for the poorest. But globally speaking, their inequality is decreasing, fortunately. Doesn't mean that there are not major challenges, not at all. And health is like a trailblazer. Health is even often, you know, ahead of the reduction in inequalities when you don't have reduction in inequality in monetary terms on many other issues, but health, you can accelerate the reduction of inequalities quicker than in many other areas. And I asked my team to kind of put together data from 2 countries, Switzerland and South Africa, and to look at how has child mortality, meaning, you know, how many children are dying before they reach their 5th birthday, how has that evolved since the year 1876? So just about not even 150 years ago in global history, very, very short moment in time. And many people forget that just 150 years ago, more than 1/4 of all children in Switzerland died before they reached their 5th birthday. The same all over the world, you know, all over Europe, US, Japan, where you want to look. More than 1/4, much, much higher than nowadays in the poorest countries in the world. So 150 years ago, basically, there was low life expectancy. People didn't grow on average more than 40 years, actually, and high child mortality everywhere. But then a huge gap opened because over the next decades, child mortality, you know, decreased in countries like Switzerland and others, but not in other parts of the world. And that's when you had this huge gap here, you know, that you see. Because of improvements in, you know, hygiene and sanitation and health and education and living conditions, but certainly also progress in health and public health, vaccines coming on board, germ theory and so on. But now look at what happened here. It's approaching the same curve. Child mortality has gone down dramatically in many countries around the world. And you could take almost any country in Africa, you would see the same. This increase, that's the effect of the AIDS epidemic. You know, that was the time in the 80s, 90s, early years of this century when so many children again were dying from AIDS, so many adults as well. You have the same in life expectancy. That's why it went up. The kind of curves widened again, the gap widened again, and now it has come down because treatment has become much more available and mortality from AIDS has gone down. But I think this is very, for me at least, it's very instructive to see, and is often what we overlook. And we are now talking about the great convergence in health because we do believe that for the first time in history, it is probably possible. And the UNAIDS report just came out last week. More than 20 million people now receive effective AIDS treatment in the world. And while at the time of the UN Assembly in 2001, about 3 million people died from AIDS every year. Now it's 1 million. 1 million too many. Don't get me wrong. Child mortality has decreased by 50%. It's great. It's half the number dying. Still, you know, of course, far too many. But the direction is quite impressive. So that's where it's hopefully going. But we have, of course, a couple of challenges. Are that the political environment has changed completely over the last couple of years. And one thing that I observe, because I'm going around the world all the time talking to governments, I can see that the notion of global solidarity has all but disappeared. You cannot convince today any politician, basically, by appealing to, you know, solidarity, people dying, we need to do something, this is an opportunity, you can save lives. We could do that many years. That's what kind of helped us to get the numbers up and the money. But nowadays, not even, and I'm just not just talking about the US here, I'm talking about almost every country. Don't get to them with talk about solidarity. And that is a real challenge. So this governments, that they are inward looking and saying, my country first, I mean, everybody has heard Trump saying America first, but he's not the only one who in different words say that. You know, it's my country that comes first and then anything else. It's not the same as to say development aid is going down. It's not or yet going down. And I often point that out as well. Actually, official development aid last year was at the highest level ever. The narrative, the justification has changed completely. And that's the challenge. And that might become a bigger challenge in the next couple of years. Because for those who still support development aid, particularly in Europe, the narrative is now, yeah, we might give money, but that is to prevent root causes of migration. For example, that's the narrative of Chancellor Merkel. She's very generous. She increased, you know, development aid. But she would also not talk about solidarity or, you know, helping people who would otherwise die. It's about root causes of migration or preventing global pandemics like Ebola. You know, everybody was scared about Ebola, and I don't want to minimize Ebola at all. 11,000 people died from Ebola, but it's nothing like the millions dying from AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria. But it was scary for many people, and the scare was this epidemic could come to our countries. That was the issue. And therefore, if you talk to them and say, yes, investing in these programs means, you know, we can maybe prevent future epidemics and that will prevent them from coming to your shores, that is an argument they understand. Everything is considered under a national security lens, if you like. That means they still provide money, but for a different reason. And I think that is something that also for us as Christians, we have to watch very carefully. And how can we change this trajectory again? Because if we want to, you know, apply some of these lessons, which I do believe we can, to other diseases, non-communicable diseases, Johanna, right? We have to work on that. and many other, of course, education is very high on the agenda. Climate change, you know, food security, all these important issues. There are lots of lessons that can be learned, how you can mobilize political and financial support. But it will be difficult if there is no sense of, yes, we are, you know, all one body, we are all equal, you know, and that is the reason why we also need to support this. And not just because that is in our own interest, because otherwise we might be affected by that. So that, for me, is the question also, you know, for us and others working on that, how can we, you know, apply these lessons, how can we promote the sense of global solidarity when we are trying to apply that to other models? And what's the role of the faith communities in that? So I want to leave you with these questions, but you can, of course, discuss any other question you want or ask me any question you have. But thank you very much for your attention.